On 280, right at Ray Street. This one in the center divide. Baseball tonight, we've got the A's and the Mariners at the Coliseum. Look for heavy traffic when that's over. I'm Michael Bennett for KQED.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Justice Stephen G. Breyer. In 2022, after 28 years on the Supreme Court, Breyer was succeeded by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. He'll talk to Sarah Isker on the occasion of his new book, Reading the Constitution, Why I Chose Pragmatism, Not Textualism. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on KQED.
Coming up tonight at 10 o'clock, support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car to KQED is easy. We'll arrange to have it picked up, running or not in most cases, and invest the funds back into our news coverage. Learn more at kqed.org/cars. This week in KQED Arts, a Latin music festival in San Jose, what to watch on TV this summer, and an Oakland sneaker shop returns, but with a twist. Find those stories and more at kqed.org/arts. KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highlands, Sacramento. It's 8 o'clock.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Scott Schaefer in for Alexis Madrigal. Political violence is nothing new in the United States. We were founded by a revolution, after all. But in the past few years, harassment, threatening emails, calls, and social media posts have more and more people in public service looking over their shoulders. Not just politicians, but judges, jurors, election officials, health officers, even librarians are the subject of anger and threats of violence. This hour on Forum, as we head into a very polarized election year, we examine a disturbing trend that increasingly is driving good people from public life. That's coming up next after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shay Stevens. President Biden has issued an executive order that limits the number of migrants allowed to cross the U.S. border from Mexico. As NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports, lawmakers want immigration reforms, but the major parties are far apart on how to go about it.
House Speaker Mike Johnson and most GOP lawmakers criticized the president's actions as too little, too late. Johnson maintained it was a political move to show action ahead of the November election.
It's window dressing. Everybody knows it. If he was concerned about the border, he would have done this a long time ago.
Top Democratic leaders defended the president's action, saying after Republicans blocked a Senate bipartisan border bill twice, the president was given no choice. But other Democrats, including members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, say the president's plan goes too far and will restrict those trying to exercise their legal right to claim asylum. The issue of border security is expected to feature prominently in key congressional races across the country this fall. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
In Arizona, lawmakers have voted to make it a crime for non-citizens to enter that state without passing through the port of entry. Voters will get to weigh on the measure at the ballot in November. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has announced three arrests in connection with the fake electors scandal. Call tells WKOW-TV that he expects there to be a legal battle.
I have no doubt that there will be a number of legal arguments raised in this case as this moves forward, but we feel confident in the charges we've brought. We're going to continue to follow the facts where they lead, and this case, like any criminal case, will follow the typical process for a prosecution.
The suspects are former Trump attorney Jim Troupas, attorney Kenneth Chesbro, Mike Roman, and Election Day coordinator for Trump. Roman is accused of delivering fake electors' paperwork intended for Vice President Mike Pence. A federal appeals court is refusing to hear any new complaints about Eileen Cannon, the judge overseeing the classified documents case against Donald Trump in Florida. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
11th Circuit Court of Appeals Chief Judge William Pryor Jr. says before May 16th, the court had received multiple complaints accusing Judge Cannon of judicial misconduct. Judge Pryor says since then, it's received more than 1,000 additional complaints raising similar allegations. Many of the complaints question her rulings and delays in issuing decisions and ask that she be removed from the case. Judge Pryor says under federal judicial guidelines, questions about the correctness of a judge's ruling or her failure to recuse do not constitute misconduct unless there's an improper motive. And he says the allegations about Judge Cannon's motives are, quote, speculative and unsupported by any evidence. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
On Wall Street, stocks closed higher. The Dow gained 140 points. This is NPR News. Four states and the District of Columbia held primaries today. In New Jersey, Democrat Andy Kim and Republican Curtis Bashaw have won their party's primaries for a U.S. Senate seat. They're vying for the seat currently held by embattled Democrat Bob Menendez, who is being tried on corruption charges. Time magazine has published a new interview with President Biden that touches on his foreign, domestic, and economic policies. As NPR's Tristan Plunkett reports, Biden says that he had no reservations about seeking re-election at his age.
President Biden pushes back on the question about being able to carry out his duties at 85 years old, the age he would cross by the end of a potential second term, saying, quote, "I can do the job better than anybody you know." On the re-election, he claims that election meddling is occurring. He declines to give any evidence, but cites internal intelligence and suggests China and, quote, "all the bad guys are rooting for Trump." Biden touts the nation's values and the U.S.'s role as a world power, adding that former President Trump wants to abandon those values and remove the U.S. from the NATO alliance. In the wide-ranging interview, he said he wouldn't comment on suggestions that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is prolonging the war in Gaza for political gain, but then says there's every reason for people to draw that conclusion. Tristan Plunkett, NPR News.
Advisors to the Food and Drug Administration have rejected MDMA, also called ecstasy, as a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. Health safety experts cite studies showing that the drug can lead to heart problems and other safety risks. The FDA is expected to announce its decision on MDMA in August. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This week on the Right Nowish podcast, Miguel Bounce Perez's culture flows through his ink. Right Nowish talks with the artist about how childhood memories influence his murals and tattoos. Hear that conversation wherever you get your podcasts. The heat advisory will remain in effect until midnight Thursday night. It'll become partly cloudy tonight with lows around 60. Wednesday will be sunny with Bay Area highs ranging from 71 at Ocean Beach to 98 in Santa Rosa tomorrow.
Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer in today for Alexis Madrigal. And this hour, we're looking at the rise of political violence. You know, in the past few years, we've seen a pretty alarming uptick in threats, intimidation, even violence directed at Republican and Democratic elected officials and others who work in the government. People like election officials, public health officers, and judges. Even librarians aren't immune. Some of them have gotten threats over things like drag queen reading hour or books that mention LGBTQ rights. The attack on the U.S. Capitol and the one on Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, at their home in San Francisco, plus the recent resignations by two members of the Berkeley City Council are just a few examples of how these threats and actual violence are playing out. As we head toward the November election, concerns about violence are real and in many ways justified. And that is our topic this hour. Joining me first are Rachel Kleinfeld. She is a senior fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She studies political violence there. Rachel, welcome.
Great to be here.
Also here is Gauri Ramachandran, Deputy Director of Elections and Government for the Brennan Center for Justice. Welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with you, Rachel, because you have sort of a global picture of all this. Give us a sense of how the U.S. compares with other countries in terms of political violence, threats, intimidation, that sort of thing, and what you've been seeing in recent years.
So first, it's really important to level set. The U.S. has a long history of political violence, from the Know Nothing Party that was against immigrants back in the 1850s, the Civil War, the Post-Civil Rights Act. So this is not new. We have upticks when people feel threatened, when the socially dominant group feels threatened and the political order supports it. It's also not all that much compared to what's happening in other countries. The U.S. is not at a civil war period. The U.S. is not where Kenya was in 2007, where there were big election riots. Most of what we're seeing is threats. Now, those threats are really worrisome. They're affecting real people. And what's not threats, the actual hate crimes that are rising, are even more affecting real people. So I don't want to underplay what's going on, but I also don't want to aggrandize it. I worry that sometimes we're normalizing the violence by talking about it so much. It's not normal. It shouldn't be happening, but it's not happening as much as it does in some other countries. And we do have a history of this. It's gone up and down, and it's important to use what we can and what we know to bring it down now.
Well, and in that regard, just south of the border, Mexico had an election on Sunday. All the attention was on the woman who got elected, the two women who were running, and the one who won in particular. But there were, I think, 37 assassinations during the course of this campaign for state, local, and then national elections. And I assume most of that is by the cartels, a way of intimidating, threatening, and eliminating people that they are worried about. Is there, in this country, is it more individualized in terms of the threats, or is it organized?
So what we're seeing is politicians are ramping up the othering of other people, minorities, immigrants, and so on, making them seem like threats and making those threats seem like something someone could use violence to do something about and would get lauded for it, the way Kyle Rittenhouse got supported for using violence. And when you see politicians do that, what you see is people who are more impulsive and more aggressive acting on those desires and saying that they should be allowed to do those things because a political party or politicians are supporting it. So people who might otherwise be committing domestic violence, hurting their dogs, hurting their kids or their wife, suddenly turn on political actors because the politicians are ramping up the anger in our country against other people. And that's what we're seeing now. And it's what we've seen at other kind of ugly periods in our history.
And Gauri Ramachandran, what are you seeing in terms of triggering these kinds of things? I mean, is it, there's sort of a, you know, obviously, I think Donald Trump is often cited as the reason for this in terms of his rhetoric, January 6th, of course. But what are you seeing in terms of, you know, the rise of these kinds of things and where they're most prevalent?
You know, we did some research over the course of last year, and it involved, in addition to some surveys, long interviews with a few dozen, with dozens of former and current state legislators. And they definitely pointed to, as you mentioned, you know, the words and the actions and the modeling of leaders, political leaders, community leaders, that sort of thing. But they also pointed to, you know, the rise of sort of inappropriate or sort of like abusive behavior and language being used on social media as a factor in what they saw as triggering it. And really disturbing to us is that many people spoke about particular issues you know, that they may not have had a really strong interest in legislating on or working on, sort of culture war issues becoming a sort of provocation almost, if you will, to these violent threats. So gun control regulation was mentioned, reproductive rights, sort of just refusal to take a really extreme position, for instance, on reproductive rights. Was mentioned as something that sometimes provoked these kinds of threats.
And to what extent is it a threat? You know, I guess really what I'm asking is, what is the spectrum of intimidation threat? Like, what is the you know, the range from like just verbal threats or comments to, you know, outright violence, like we saw Steve Scalise getting shot, the Republican congressman from Louisiana at a baseball practice, Paul Pelosi. Like, what's the range? Like, how do you measure that, Gauri?
That's a great question, and we actually because of those distinctions between different types of intimidating or abusive behavior. In our surveys, we actually asked local and state officials about that whole range. So we said, you know, have you experienced insults, harassment, threats, or physical attacks? And that, to my mind, indicates that when people, you know, ticked that threats box, that means they're really talking about a serious threat. They're not talking about something in the category of an insult, which, while, you know, not nice, is something I think a lot of politicians would expect they might be subject to. And in the threat category, the numbers were really, really high. So within the past 3 years, 43% of the state legislators we surveyed said that they had experienced threats. The numbers were obviously super, super high when you talk about insults. A supermajority had experienced insults, but 43% said they experienced threats. And I believe about 2%, which is a small number, but not small when you think about what they're saying, about 2% had actually experienced physical attacks.
Yeah. And I should say we are going to be joined later in the hour by a couple of elected officials from California who have experienced these things firsthand. Rachel, I think it was you, your group, who did a look at threats in San Diego County, where some colleagues, people reported were threats from their own colleagues. Am I remembering that correctly?
So that was Rachel Locke, a fabulous researcher at the Kroc Institute in San Diego.
Oh, a different Rachel.
but a close colleague who did an amazing study asking county officials about threats that they were experiencing. And you're right, not only did over 75% of San Diego County officials experience threat, but a number of them were from their own colleagues. And we do hear that across the board with local and state officials, that some percentage of the threats are coming from within.
Gary, a couple of you, I think both of you have mentioned social media. Talk about that and how it plays into this rise in threats, intimidation, and violence.
Sure. Many of the people we spoke to individually talked about social media as a sort of, you know, exacerbating or amplifying factor. And what really struck me is how many talked about their concern for their own constituents on social media. So a number of large numbers of people in the survey mentioned that one of the impacts of these threats and this intimidation was to sort of deter them from engaging with constituents on social media, just, you know, it was causing people to exit from that world. And in the interviews, a lot of folks mentioned that the reason was concern for constituents. So they were really concerned about their own supporters being subjected to harassing language or bullying kind of language, you know, in these comment forums on their social media pages, and just not wanting to host a space for that.
Rachel, any thoughts about the pandemic and how that has exacerbated this problem? Because I know, you know, kind of a staple of elected officials, certainly for members of Congress when they fly back to their districts, is sort of a town hall, you know, where the constituents get a chance to ask questions, meet their representatives, and so on. I know during the pandemic, out of necessity, a lot of these meetings were held on Zoom. But that, of course, is also much safer and easier for them to control who can get in and so on and so forth. What impact has that period of time, that pandemic, had, even though now folks can get back together safely?
I think the pandemic had a number of effects. First of all, we know from pandemics across history that disease exacerbates people's feelings about other people being scary, especially immigrants and foreigners, but really any kind of other people, because they could be carrying disease. It's a very deep mental way of thinking about things. And so no surprise that that kind of feeling got exacerbated during the pandemic. The pandemic also increased anxiety. People who were given to being anxious got much more so. Mental health problems really increased during the pandemic. Access to therapists really decreased. And so a lot of the anxiety that we're seeing and the fear is a spillover from some of those feelings moving into the political realm. And then conspiracy theories increased during the pandemic. Some of these were political and some of these weren't. But if you don't believe that the pandemic was real, or if you don't believe that masking helps, then the things that your politicians were telling you to do could seem suspect. And if you believed that that was a conspiracy, it makes it more easy to believe that other things that your politicians are doing are conspiracies. We know that people who believe one conspiracy theory tend to believe many more. There's kind of a gateway in. And so the fact that Trump at that period of time was really pushing some of the more conspiratorial beliefs about how the pandemic was spread and what to do was probably extremely unhelpful in terms of the election conspiracies and so on that came next.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we return, more on increasing concerns about political violence, and we'll be hearing from some elected officials as well. You're listening to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. We'll be right back.
I'm Guy Marzorati. On Forum's 9 p.m. rebroadcast, California Republicans may lack political power in Sacramento, but in recent years, they've made inroads on local school boards. Now, some of those conservative officials are facing recall elections, including in Riverside County and the Bay Area. We'll look at what's behind the recalls and what they say about the politics of public education in our state. That's tonight at 9 here on KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Golden Voice, presenting singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Kishi Bashi performing his new album, Cantos, with Sweet Loretta, September 15th at the Regency Ballroom, tickets at AXS.com, and from Xfinity. Customers can get wall-to-wall Wi-Fi with Xfinity Gateway and XFi Pod. That extends coverage to hard-to-reach areas. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. The Forum rebroadcast continues at 8:20.
And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here this hour for Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the rise of personal threats aimed at elected officials, judges, and others who work in government jobs. My guests are Rachel Kleinfeld. She's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she studies democracy, the rule of law, and political violence. Also, Gauri Ramachandran, deputy director of elections and government at the Brennan Center for Justice. And joining us now from Sacramento is Scott Wiener. He's a California state senator representing San Francisco. Senator Wiener, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me just start. You have been, it seems to me, targeted for years. You are Jewish. You are openly gay. You have been, a lightning rod for all kinds of, I would say, in many cases, extremists. Describe, if you would, the experiences you've had over the last few years.
Yeah, and thanks for talking about this important issue, because a lot of elected officials are impacted, and especially people at the local level, school board members, city council members, who really have no support. For me, it really started around 2020, and overwhelmingly the threats that I get are related to my work to support LGBTQ people, particularly LGBTQ youth. I've gotten some around vaccines, for sure, but particularly LGBTQ youth-related policy to support these kids. And so in 2020, I had a bill that we were able to pass to simply say that LGBTQ young people who are in Romeo and Juliet situations, where you have like a 19-year-old who is dating or having sex with a 17-year-old, for example. So college age, high school age kids who are having sex, which is statutory rape in California. Under the previous law in California, judges had the ability to keep straight kids off of the sex offender registry if it was not an abusive relationship. But the gay kids, the judge was required to put the kid on the registry, even if it was totally consensual and there was nothing predatory about it. So just blatant discrimination. So we did this bill that I authored, which had broad support from law enforcement, civil rights groups, et cetera, to say, let's treat the gay kids exactly the way we've always treated the straight kids, that the court has discretion to look and see if there was predatory behavior and then decide whether to put the person on the sex offender registry. The QAnon latched on to that. It was fueled by a lot of these big right-wing conspiracy theory accounts on YouTube and Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Donald Trump Jr., Rush Limbaugh, others latched on. And it caused me to receive thousands of death threats on social media, phone calls to my office, emails. And it's just gone on from there. And it's been pretty constant over the last 4 or 5 years. They've arrested some people. I've had to testify before a jury. So it's been a lot.
And the cases where they've caught folks, or even just your sense of who it is that's sending these threats on social media and elsewhere, are they mostly outside California, or is it a pretty, you know, balanced mix?
Some of them they can't tell. We send everything to our security, and it goes to law enforcement. Some of them they can't tell. Some of them they figure out the people are, you know, in Arkansas or Michigan or wherever. And so there's not a lot they can do about that. And obviously less likely they're going to physically do something if they're thousands of miles away. But the two cases where they have arrested people, and one of them pled guilty, one of them was convicted by a jury. One of those guys was in the East Bay, and one was in LA. So some of them are local. And these threats can be very, very explicit, that they're going to come and find me with a rifle, that, you know, there are ones around, you know, they're going to chop my head off and send it to my mother. They're going to, you know, rape me and kill me, mutilate my genitals. I mean, really explicit, disgusting stuff.
Just want to read a comment from Camille, who says, I want to thank Scott Wiener for all of his service. We have a non-binary kid and live close to the caster. I appreciate everything he's doing. It's very upsetting how much harassment there is against trans kids. How does all this affect you, Senator Wiener? Because there was a viral video just recently. I think you were at SFO, and you were confronted by some pro-Palestinian protesters, and they were, you know, shouting things like, you know, you're a genocide enabler and you're killing babies. What do you do differently as a result of all this? I mean, I just can't imagine how you deal with it.
Yeah, and that's been more recent since the outbreak of the war in Gaza. I'm, you know, someone who, a Jewish elected official, I support the state of Israel as Jewish homeland. I've also been critical of the Israeli government and the conduct of the war. But it's unfortunate because the people who get targeted locally are overwhelmingly Jews. There are plenty of non-Jews who have opinions, but it's people like me and Supervisor Raphael Mandelman and Manny Yekutiel, who's a community leader. It's the Jews who are getting targeted. So query why we're being the ones singled out. I've not gotten really death threats relating to the war in Gaza, but I do periodically get pretty severely physically harassed. Happened at a bar once. It happened on the street. It happened at a event at the Academy of Sciences, and then it happened at the airport when I was leaving a plane to see my parents, and someone followed me off and stalked me through the terminal. I don't mind if people, when people come up to me and say, hey, I disagree with you about what's happening in the Middle East, I welcome that. I'm happy to have those conversations. But when people start harassing and trying to intimidate you, and they think that that's going to get you to change your position, first of all, it's the opposite of democracy. We shouldn't be doing democracy by, or government by, whoever gets intimidated the most. But it is, it's very, very unpleasant. And there are times when it's scary because you don't know if the person's going to escalate to the next level. And unfortunately, with the way social media is, people go down like these wormholes, and they decide that you are either pure good or pure evil. And they don't look at your nuanced position and everything that you've said. They just know that they've seen that you're an evil person, and so that can escalate things.
Yeah. I know you need to get back to work up there at the Capitol, but before I let you go, there is an assembly bill to allow campaign funds to be used for security. I think last year Governor Newsom vetoed it because it wasn't specific enough in terms of how it could be spent. But I think a revised bill passed the assembly unanimously, 72-0. Just say if you think, you know, if you think that's going to pass this time, and, you know, have you addressed the governor's concerns? I think it's Mia Bonta's bill, actually.
Yeah, I assume she has. I am focused on all the details. That's a good bill. It's important. People need to understand that if you're not like a mayor of a big city or a governor, or like the Speaker of the House or the President, we don't get that same level of security. So giving elected officials the ability, at least some instances, to be able to protect themselves is important. And so I support that bill.
Yeah. All right. State Senator Scott Wiener, thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe out there.
Thank you so much.
Let me go back to our guests here, Rachel Kleinfeld and Gauri Ramachandran. You've been listening to Senator Wiener. Rachel, starting with you, what jumps out at you at what you just heard?
So first of all, it's horrible. It's horrible that our neighbors, our librarians, our school board officials, people who run for office, you know, those are hard jobs. They're not very remunerative. They make you work over your dinner hour and stay away from your kids and families. We need good people to run for these jobs. And if people get intimidated the way so many are, we're not going to have good people run for these jobs. So it's really important for people to know that this is happening and to show their support to these politicians. At the same time, it's really important to know that the vast majority of Americans do not agree with violence and that there are many, many groups working to stand against violence. And I hope that people will hear something like the senator's comments and say, okay, where can I sign up against this? Can I join a Common Ground USA to get a whole community to stand against violence or an Over Zero to uplift regular voices so that people can take some agency rather than hearing these things and thinking, gosh, this is just awful and getting sad.
And Gauri, what about you? And, you know, what impact do you think this has on our democracy?
So one of the things we studied in our report is exactly that, the impact on democracy. And unfortunately, you know, our finding was that there are a lot of really broad impacts on democracy from this behavior. Large numbers of respondents to our survey said that they are deterred from doing public events, as you've mentioned earlier in the session. People are deterred from doing media appearances, which is, you know, something that's part and parcel of, you know, running a political campaign and running for office. You got to talk to the media and let voters know what your positions are. People are being deterred from bringing their families to these public events. So there's, you know, just really reduced opportunities for constituents to have those opportunities to interact with their elected officials or with people who are seeking to become elected officials and have that nuanced conversation. So the impacts are strong. But one thing we also found, to really echo what Rachel has said, is that something that many people said really helps in these situations is when other leaders speak up against this behavior and say, that's not democratic, that's not how we run a democracy, particularly when someone from across the aisle does that. That's incredibly helpful. You know, when media reports on these threats and this abuse, they can make sure to interview people who are willing to speak up and leaders who are willing to say that's not acceptable and this is not the way that we should voice our disagreements.
We are talking, of course, about the rise in violence in politics here in the United States at the local, state, and federal level. We'd love to hear from you. What do you think about this topic and, you know, whether violence is ever justified for political reasons? What do you think is behind the rise in threats? And have you ever personally threatened, been threatened because of the work that you do in government or elsewhere? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, it's 866-733-6786. Or you can reach us on all of our social media platforms. We're at KQED Forum. And our email is forum@kqed.org. We have one comment from Noel on Discord who writes, it seems to me that this can scare away decent people who want to run for office. Candidate quality has really gone down, especially on the Republican side. And I want to sort of pivot from elected officials to judges. And Rachel, you know, we just saw a trial in Manhattan with President Trump being convicted on 34 felonies. The judge in that case, Juan Marchand, had to, you know, issue a gag order, which Trump violated numerous times. And then after the trial, he called him the devil. What impact do you think this sort of attack on judges, on jurors, on people related to the justice system is having?
So it's a real problem because in a democracy, you basically have two ways to peacefully settle disputes. We've got over 300 million people in this country. We have really big differences of opinion. How do you deal with that? Well, you can choose to agree that whoever wins an election gets to represent you until the next election, and then you get another try. That's one way to peacefully settle differences. And the other way is to go to court if it's a more criminal or civil issue and agree to abide by what the jury or what the judge says. once you start to take both of those methodologies and say they're not legitimate, the only thing you have left is violence to settle difference. And so what we're seeing with federal judges, we've seen a rise more than double the number of serious threats to federal judges just from 2019 to 2022. The numbers have more than doubled, almost tripled in terms of serious threats. And I'm the daughter of a federal judge. I know what that's like. You put the person who's threatening you, you put their picture on the fridge. The kids have to see it every day. They have to look behind them to see if someone in a car is following them. You know, you're talking about small children, not just federal judges that have to deal with these kinds of threats. This is not the way we want our democracy to go. I've worked in conflictual countries. You don't want to be in a violent country like that.
Yeah. All right, let's open the phone lines. Again, the number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And let's start with Noah in Oakland. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm primarily reacting to something that Senator Wiener said on the air just now about, you know, protesters hurling invective at him and him not feeling safe. I think it's extremely dangerous and irresponsible of him to come on this program and conflate people accusing him of things that they believe he's complicit in and political violence. Political violence is not when you feel uneasy at someone else's political views. Peaceful protest does not have to be demure and quiet, right? That kind of protest has never achieved anything. Hmm. Peaceful protest is about civil disobedience, and it gets in people's way. And lastly, if you remember, on this program during the UC grad student strike a while ago, we had a UC labor relations person come on and start making all these accusations about, you know, we want our campuses to be safe. We just want our campuses to be safe. You know, tacitly accusing protesters on the strike line of somehow making campus unsafe. And so this is just it's a broad tactic by people in power to refuse the legitimacy of the requests and accusations of people who they politically disagree with.
Do you think that there's any legitimacy at all or concern? There should be concern about, you know, the spectrum of threats, intimidation that people face? Elected officials.
See, you're doing it too. Threats and intimidation are different. Threats and intimidation are different from accusing someone that they are making a bad political choice or being harmful, right? And it doesn't matter what kind of language you use to do that. If you're just telling someone, look, you are, you know, in a powerful position and you are using your power in a bad way. Okay. And that is not political violence.
Okay. Where does it cross the line? I'm just curious. Regression. Where do you think, Noah, what's the line? Like, where does it cross the line?
The line is when you start to threaten someone's personal safety, people around them, when you, you know, if you hit them with bodily harm, anything like that. But violence is not, I mean, Scott Wiener has not suffered anything except for a little bit of political pressure as a result of this, right? No one has threatened his family or him as a result of the way he's conducting himself.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that he comes on here and makes that argument, it justifies violent repression against people he simply doesn't agree with. We're seeing this on campus protests now.
Yeah. Okay. Noah, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Gary, what are your thoughts about Noah's views on that and that, you know, that spectrum of peacefully yelling, but peacefully not threatening anybody? Like, what impact does that have, or how should we deal with those things?
You know, I think that it really goes back to a question you asked, you know, at the top of the program about, you know, the range of things that people experience. And it's why we were really careful in our study to, you know, give people the option of distinguishing between, you know, something that they would put in the category of insults, which is, you know, probably something that's, you know, protected free speech, and something that they would put in the category of threats. We, to the state legislators that we surveyed, we actually provided definitions of these different categories. The definition of harassment included examples like stalking, right? Things like that, which I think are things that would legitimately make someone fear for their safety. And I think what's striking is that the numbers were still really high of people choosing, you know, that category threats. The numbers were 43% for state legislators experiencing that. The numbers were quite high, I think about 1 in 5 for local officials. So I do think there is a problem in terms of too many things that actually do cross that line.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very important when we look at solutions, policy recommendations, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It is extremely important to make sure that we are leaving plenty of space for legitimate political protest.
Great. We need to take a little break here. Sorry to cut you off there. We're going to continue this conversation. Give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or reach us at KQED Forum on social media. Coming up in the next hour of Forum with guest host Guy Marzorati, California Republicans may lack political power in Sacramento, but in recent years they've made inroads on local school boards. Now some of those conservative officials are facing recall elections, including in Riverside County and the Bay Area. We'll look at what's behind the recalls and what they say about the volatile politics of public education in our state. To listen to past Forum shows, go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this hour for Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the rise in personal threats, intimidation, stalking, and in some cases, violence in our politics today. My guests are Rachel Kleinfeld. She's a senior fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she studies democracy and political violence. Gauri Ramachandran, deputy director of elections and government for the Brennan Center for Justice. And let's go to the phones now. We're going to go to Berkeley. And Eid, welcome.
Good morning. Yeah, violence is wrong, political or not. I was here in the city of San Francisco when Mayor Moscone and
Harvey Milk,
were murdered by Dan White, and it affected us a lot. It affected us a lot. Violence is not acceptable, whether it's done by people, nations, anybody. We are not civilized at all. The fact is, most of this hate that's surrounding the whole country and the Bay Area is because lack of education. We need to educate people about the word Semitic. It refers to both Arabs and Jews. Second, that the whole conflict that's bringing all of this demonstration, and I was here also, met Mario Savio, was here in Berkeley since 1965.
So you've got a lot of history here in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, let me just get our, if I could, let our guests respond too, because, we did in San Francisco, Rachel, of course, have those tragic assassinations of the mayor, George Moscone, and Supervisor Harvey Milk, the first openly gay elected official in California back in 1978. So that history we have here, especially for those who remember it or were around when it happened or just are aware of it, it adds a special layer of concern, I think, for those here in the Bay Area.
That's absolutely right. When people start seeing issues in black and white and start seeing their side as all good and the other side as all bad, it's much easier for folks who are more impulsive and more aggressive to commit violence. And it's never okay, as your caller just said. I think what's most important to recognize is that we have the most leverage against our own side. And so speaking out against the normalization of violence on your side, if you're on the left, or on your side, if you're on the right, is the most important way to change it. And we can all do that.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Oakland is our next stop. And Olga, welcome.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for having me. I wanted to share my personal experience with activism and when activists take a little bit more of a escalated level. So I stopped by my ex-boss's house to pick up some signs, and I saw a huge demonstration, and he is an Oakland City Council member. There were about 40 people yelling and screaming into megaphones, literally standing on his porch, and he was discussing the homeless management policy. So So protesters were protesting that policy. And I stayed with him for about 4 hours while he was suggesting amendments to the policy. I don't know how he was able to think, let alone provide some amendments. But from the personal perspective, I have to say, I did not feel safe staying in that house. Even though I'm a pretty courageous person, I feel like, but it was tremendously uncomfortable. And we were talking about we need to alert the police to be ready, because you don't know when you're in situations like that, you do not know what actually is going to happen. If somebody will try to throw a stone in the window or so. One thing that I want to highlight, which your speaker said, that people a lot of times say, you know, this is bad, this is good. Majority of people do not take time to read legislation, and the devil is in details a lot of times. Yeah. So people need to educate themselves, read legislation, and whether they're protesting or what they are standing for.
Yeah, that is a really...
Thank you so much. Thank you for your work.
Yeah, Olga, thank you. Thanks for calling in. And Gauri, you know, a couple things there. She used the word making people uncomfortable, and that really often is the point of, you know, again, peaceful protest is to make your express your point of view, whether it's pro-Palestinian, pro-Israel, whatever it might be. And that, I think most people would agree is, you know, that's well within the bounds of a democracy, First Amendment rights and so on. But when you do get these conspiracy theories that are amplified, manufactured, and then amplified on things, whether it's, you know, right-wing cable shows on radio or television, that really, it makes it hard because, to Olga's point, people don't really look into the details. They just sort of hear the allegation or the rumor and they run with it. Gauri?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think what we're all really grappling with here is how do you respond in terms of policy reform and making sure that people feel safe so that you can actually have more participation in democracy, right? In so that people can feel safe voicing their views, people who take the time to read the legislation, as your caller was mentioning, feel like they are safe if they go to a public event and speak out about it, right? What can we do that makes people feel safer while not actually shutting down legitimate political speech? And it reminds me of something many of the people, the legislators we interviewed, mentioned, which is that the proliferation of guns in this country is a real exacerbation of this problem here. It's a real factor in why people don't feel safe at these public events, because, you know, you don't know who might be possessing a harmful weapon like that. So one of the recommendations we actually made in our report is about gun control, in fact, and about allowing candidates and public officials to forbid open and concealed carry of weapons at public events. Unfortunately, there are a number of states that have moved in the wrong direction on this issue and have permitted more carrying of weapons in government buildings and locations like that.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. And Martina in Oakland, you're next.
Hi there. I just wondered if the guests could comment on which side, because it seems to me that the violence and the threats are coming from one side more. And I just don't understand why that's not acknowledged, because you have to acknowledge something to deal with the truth. So if you could deal with which right or left, Republican, Democrat, it appears that it's coming from one side. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. Well, and your perception is it's coming from which side?
It's coming from the right.
Yeah. Rachel Kleinfeld, what do you think?
It's overwhelmingly clear. Sure. So I don't understand why it's not talked about.
Yeah. Rachel?
So it is true that right now we're seeing more threats from the right, vastly more threats from the right. We are also seeing, however, the people threatened being about equal on the right and the left. So the threats are coming from the right, but often against the right. There are also threats from the left against the left. They're more on the right. But the people being threatened are both Republicans and Democrats, and are mostly moderates on both sides. What we're seeing is that in the 1960s, most threats and political violence was on the left. And then it started moving in the 70s and 80s toward the right. And one of the real differences is that the left tended to focus on property crime, lots of bombs left overnight in places where there weren't people, whereas the right focuses on people and harming people. So not only are you getting more threats from the right, but they're affecting real people in a different way. But that's not to let the left off the hook, because when we see justifications of violence, they're almost equal between left and right and have long been. So it's more likely to be coming from the right now, just as the caller says. But we should be really worried about the normalization that's starting to happen on the left, like an earlier caller who couldn't see any protest as potentially violent. You know, obviously, peaceful protest is crucial in our country. It's absolutely essential to democracy. And some protests are not peaceful. We need to be able to acknowledge both things, and we need to be able to call out our own side. But this caller's right that it's mostly from the right now.
Yeah, Martina, thanks very much for the call. And, you know, just thinking back to Noah's comments about Senator Wiener, Rachel, I think that video that I looked at of him walking through the airport, it's kind of a Rorschach test, I guess. You know, it's true. No one laid hands on him. I wouldn't want to be subjected to that. Of course, I'm not an elected official either. But, it, you know, one person's peaceful protest is another person's, like, that scares the hell out of me and really is not something I want to be subject to.
It's really true. And, you know, one thing I think about is we absolutely need to preserve peaceful protest. It is the major way that people can express themselves in a democracy. It's essential. And when Proud Boys block a drag queen story hour and are just intimidating, they're not doing anything, but they're there. They're often armed and they're there in front of women and kids. We're able to say, gosh, that's intimidating. We don't like that. But if protesters are blocking an entrance or blocking a way out of an airport or something and yelling and screaming, they might also be peaceful, just as the Proud Boys are peaceful and not using violence at the drag queen story hour. But we should be able to see that that can be intimidating as well. Where we draw the line is going to depend on regular people making their own judgments. But I think acknowledging that what's good for the goose is good for the gander is important, because this violence will only stop when we can hold hands across difference with everyone who says violence needs to come down and start bringing it down on all sides.
I want to bring in another elected official. Eric Swalwell is a Democrat in Congress. He represents the 15th District of California, including parts of the East Bay. Representative Swalwell, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
So you were a House impeachment manager for Trump's second impeachment. You were threatened by a number of people, Roger Stone included, before the 2020 election. Talk about your experiences in this realm of being threatened and your family being threatened. You have three young kids.
Yeah, it feels overwhelming. And if I'm being honest, me and my family have probably become numb to it, because you just can't keep up with the volume of threats, and I'm talking multiple threats, often daily, and you just hope that law enforcement has the resources to, you know, track down the threats, and I do the best I can with the limited resources we have, you know, to protect my family and also protect my staff. Now, the aim of these threats is to intimidate, and that's not going to change, you know, how I do my job or how my family and I, you know, live our lives. We're committed to, you know, serving my constituents and have adjusted, you know, to make safety precautions. But if the aim is to, you know, have us back down, we're just not going to do that. Mm. But it does highlight the need, I think, for a couple things. One, changes in the law as far as, you know, what is prosecutable, because right now the standards are, I think, far too high. Two, changes in the resources that we need at all levels so that public officials of all parties at all offices are protected. And then three, and this is the hardest one, actually, the money. You know, we can find the way to protect, you know, public officials. We can, you know, change the law through legislation. But finding Republicans and Democrats to jointly condemn these threats is most important. And we've not seen my Republican colleagues willing to call out, you know, these calls for violence. And that unity, I think, is the best antidote.
Yeah. The one incident that I think was the most concerning to me, and I would imagine you as well, is last year you got 5 threatening voicemails, I think in a single day, threatening to kill you and your 3 children, who are all under 10. A Florida man was arrested. He pleaded guilty. Talk about that experience. And, you know, was there a measure of, I don't know, relief, satisfaction, whatever the word is, when he was finally held accountable?
Well, yes, there was a measure of relief. And it also just so happened that at the time, you know, the threats came in and law enforcement investigated them. And thank God my kids are of the age that they don't even understand and have to worry about that. That's our job. But we were notified that the individual was from Florida, like that they tracked him down, and that he was from Florida, and we were not too many miles away in the same area of Florida when we learned that he was from there and had been there, you know, for a couple days on a family vacation. And that was a little jarring to think that, you know, he had made this threat and we just, without knowing where he was from, had a previously scheduled family vacation that took us pretty close to, you know, where he lived. And that's also concerning, that it sometimes it's individuals who want to make threats against you. We got to guard against that. But then there's some people who, if you give them the opportunity, because they have this notion of carrying out political violence, you could just kind of walk right into an opportunity for them to carry it out.
Yeah. You've been in Congress over a decade. I think you were first elected in 2010. Have you seen a change in
2012? Yeah.
2012. Sorry. So more than a decade. Have you seen a change in the term, in the way that just like your colleagues across the aisle deal with this issue and the willingness to come together to find some common ground to make some of the changes you mentioned at the top?
No, unfortunately. And just over the weekend, it was on Meet the Press that Senator Tom Cotton, a Republican, he was elected with me in the House in 2012. Now in the Senate, you know, he was asked if he would condemn the threats of violence that are being made against the jurors in the Trump trial. And he couldn't do that. And it was just so puzzling to me, because when protesters went to Tucker Carlson's house years ago and harassed his wife and kids when he was actually not there, I went on social media and I said, we don't do this, that crosses a line. You know, when, you know, a madman went and sat outside the house of, you know, Justice Kavanaugh, although I don't support Justice Kavanaugh, I condemn that, because it takes, you know, both parties to show these individuals that we don't give you a permissive lane. And that in our country, we prefer voting over violence as to how we settle our political scores.
Yeah.
Our political contest.
Yeah. All right. Well, Eric Swalwell, thank you so much for your service. I know this must be very difficult on you and your family, and I appreciate your hanging in there and doing the people's business.
My pleasure. Thank you all.
All right. Well, we're getting to the end of the hour, but let's see if we can sneak in another phone call here. Will in San Francisco. Make it brief if you could.
Sure. Thanks for taking my call, and really appreciate this discussion. Super, super important. I was curious about any proactive, like even specific, like tactical recommendations for how, you know, a regular person like me or whomever, you know, could get involved, both in terms of, you know, pushing back on sort of violence against civic leaders at all levels, including judges and others outside the political spectrum, but also maybe the broader societal issue of how do we improve our communications and our dialogue, you know, with those we disagree with? Sometimes we don't even meet those people in our daily lives very often, you know, and I think, you know, tactically,
yeah.
Again, like, are there organizations I could join, donate to, contribute, volunteer with, et cetera? So
yeah.
I'm curious if there are any proactive suggestions.
Yeah, good question. Rachel Orgari, Rachel, you first, are you aware of any that, you know, the caller could contribute to or get in touch with?
Absolutely. I'm thrilled this was the last question, because there are so many ways to get involved. The easiest is just in your own community. If you're hearing people, especially on your side, because you have the most leverage, normalizing any kind of violence, just say, you know, we can't normalize violence on our side. It will make it worse. It'll normalize violence on the other side. And so speaking out in your normal day-to-day conversations and your social media, really important. When you see violence or violent speech or othering speech on social media, really important to stand up for those people. We know that when you stand up for those people, it doesn't necessarily change the person writing bad or racist things, but it can really make other people stand up. And then if you want to join a group. Over Zero, Common Ground USA. Gary might have some others, but those would be my top two.
All right. Thank you so much. Thanks to both of you, Rachel Kleinfeld from the Carnegie Endowment, Gauri Ramachandran from the Brennan Center for Justice, and our elected officials who called in earlier as well. And to the callers for all your comments and calls as well. This is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum ahead with Guy Marzorati. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation,